Good morning, everybody. Good morning. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. What's wrong with you? How many people have heard that in your lives? Okay, come on, be honest. How many people? What's wrong with you? All right, we're going to be looking at the fourth step. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what's wrong with me. I don't know about anybody else in here, but from about age 4 to about age 12, I knew something was desperately wrong with me. I was repressed emotionally. I mean, I had real difficulty being able to deal with life. I would start things and not finish them. I joined the wrestling team. I did one practice. I joined the Boy Scouts. I went on one camp out. I took guitar lessons. I started guitar lessons. I did two lessons and then stole the guitar. You know, I mean, I went to college for about 5.5 years. And my last 3 years in college, I got 6 credits. Okay, you know, I had difficulty dealing. I couldn't show up with comfort. I couldn't step out easily. I don't want to do it. Okay, that was mainly, I got things to do. I really don't want to do it. And this is from age maybe 4 to age 12. But if you would have looked at me from the outside, you would have seen a pretty normal kid. I was like a normal kid. There wasn't, you know, cops or anything. I mean, I was just a typical normal kid. But I knew something was desperately wrong inside me. I discover alcohol, and I start to use alcohol as a tool to be able to deal. If I'm going to go to the school dance, you're absolutely certain I'm going to be putting some ballast in there. You know, I'm going to have a 6-pack of beer. If I was going to go to a party, I'd start drinking a couple hours before so I could walk into that party and be okay. Now, all of a sudden, if you're looking at me from the outside, all of a sudden it seems like there's some real things going wrong with me. I'm crashing cars and everything, and everybody's coming up to me and saying, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm saying to myself, nothing. Finally, I just discovered alcohol. There's nothing wrong now, you know. I've got a tool. So the thing is with alcoholics, we know so many things that we're wrong about. We're absolutely certain of so many things that aren't true. But we'll go to the grave, you know, believing these things. And you know, my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous was really waking up to the fact that I had been wrong about everything. And you got to understand, when I walked in my first day or my first week in AA, I really thought I understood things better than you all. Gee, oh my God, look at this crowd, you know. I really thought I had a very complicated intellectual perception that just cut through the hypocrisy, and I could see truth at such a deep level that it was such a burden to have this mind that could think at such a level that, you know, I needed to medicate myself. I mean, you know, and the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, the process of the steps, pulled me away from these misconceptions that I had about my life. You know, what's wrong with you? If you're alcoholic, and I think most people are that are sitting in this room, you are suffering from an illness. It's not only mental, it's not only physical, but it's spiritual too. There is something desperately wrong with your spirit. I don't believe that we've been, you know, created here and placed on this earth to have 6 spirits. I believe that God would want us to be the type of people that we can be. I think that it's self-inflicted a lot of times, this spirit malady that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, in the book, you'll hear practically in every chapter are examples of what the spiritual malady is. But I'll sum it up like this. I don't believe I'm alcoholic because I drank a lot or I drank a long time. I believe I drank a lot and drank a long time because I'm alcoholic. I believe that as a child, I for some crazy reason, who knows why, and you know what, in AA sometimes knowing why is the booby prize, okay? Who cares why? You know, knowing why, it's like, okay, you're on the Titanic, and the Titanic is going down, and they're yelling, get on the lifeboat, get on the lifeboat. And you're there, well, I ain't going nowhere until I find out who was supposed to be watching for icebergs. You know what I mean? You're going down. Who cares why? Get in the lifeboat. And that's what we tell you in AA. Knowing why is the booby prize. You know, if you really have to know why, go to therapy for 40 years like Woody Allen. Anyway, what's wrong with you? I'm going to list a couple of things, and I want everybody to be honest and just ask yourself, have you felt this way? Do you suffer from this currently? Have you gone through the steps and found that your life is better? Did you think this was how alcoholism presented? Because for the longest time, the only thing I thought about alcoholism was you drank a whole lot. I know more about alcoholism now. And I know drinking is one symptom, one manifestation of alcoholism, but there's many. Okay, it talks in the book, we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can once again experience the ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. Does anybody relate to that? Have you ever been restless, irritable, and discontented? Let me put it this way. If you're going to AA and you haven't gone through the steps, are you restless, irritable, and discontented on like a continuing basis? Yes. Okay? Be honest. Some of the other symptomology is resentment. Have you ever just gotten really pissed at somebody and hung on to it? I mean, here's what would happen. I would wake up in the morning in the last 5 years of my drinking and probably into 2 years of my sobriety, and I'd come out of a deep sleep and I'd go, those bastards! You know what I mean? It's like the first thing I would think about is those bastards! Have you ever done that? You know? Resentment at that level is a waste of time. It's a waste of your life. It steals precious minutes where you can be using the same energy that you're using to resent somebody. You could be using that same energy to enjoy life to its absolute fullest. This is part of alcoholism, that deep-seated resentment. How about self-centered fear? Now, self-centered fear manifests in a number of ways. It manifests in some very blatant ways, like I don't like to go to court, you know, or I'm giving an oral report in front of the whole class. I feel like really not comfortable about this. There's a number of different ways. Or I've got to run across the gymnasium and ask a girl to dance, you know. I mean those are manifestations of self-centered fear, that anxiety that you feel. Have you ever been to the point where you know you should ask for a raise, or you know you should go back to school, or you know you should do this, or you know you should do that, but you were stopped because of that anxiety? You didn't feel like you could do it. There was a sense of impending doom about the whole thing. Yeah, I know it's the right thing for me to do, but I don't feel comfortable doing it, so I'm going to avoid it. I'm going to do an end around, and I'm going to figure out how not to take care of that. That's another way that alcoholism presents. How about guilt and shame and remorse? I know some things about alcoholics. I've worked with, you know, hundreds of alcoholics, and I know some things about us. And I would say not everybody that walks into AA is an alcoholic. There's some psychopathic, you know, individuals that are that have they're evil. You know, they're rare, but they show up in the meetings every once in a while. I'm talking about, like, the alcoholics. I'm talking about the people who have alcoholism who show up in AA. We are not bad people. We suffer at really, really deep levels, the guilt, the remorse, and the shame for the things we've done, for the things we haven't done, because there's guilt by omission. How many times should you have shown up in your life and you decided you just couldn't deal with it and you avoided it? You know, so we feel this, and it starts to corrode our self-esteem, and we start to feel like real scumbags after year after year after year of this, because we just can't step up to the plate like normal people. What's wrong with me? All right? This is another way that alcoholism presents. I'm not even talking about the acute stages of alcoholism where terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, suicidal thoughts. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about the basic way alcoholism presents. And when we can feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once upon taking a few drinks, drinks we see other people taking with impunity, we understand that there's a solution for our alcoholism. The solution for our alcoholism is alcohol. Except the solution backfires on us because it's a progressive illness. And it gets worse, it never gets better. Yes, we may be able to escape that emotional bondage today for several hours if we get drunk, but tomorrow it's going to come back even stronger, all that emotional turmoil that we're going through. So alcohol's a solution. It's just a bad solution for alcoholism. You got to understand, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a sobriety problem. Think about this. Think about the last couple of times you went to the liquor store or the last couple of times you went to the bar before you got sober. Think about this. How did you go there? How did you? Because here's how I did it. I would get off of work at 4 o'clock and I'd get in my car and I'd be doing 45 and a 35, and God help you if you're going slow, if you're Clem Cadiddle Hopper in front of me, because I'm going to the liquor store. I'm going to get out of my way. You know, I'd like run you over. I'd run into the liquor store, and I might as well have been going up to the clerk saying, will you hurry up? Will you get this lady out of my way? I got my bottle of vodka. I need to get home. You know, here's the money. Come on, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. You got to help me out here. I'm sober. I'm sober. Can't you see? I'm sober. Hurry up. I mean, think about it. Think about it. Do you have a drinking problem or do you have a sober problem? Because as soon as you crack the lid on that vodka, it's like, ah, you know? You hear so many things that are wrong out there. There's so many misconceptions. There's so much stigma. There's so much misunderstanding about alcoholism. We don't have a drinking problem. We have an ability to deal inside our own bodies problem. Now, the more I understand about the Big Book, the more I cannot believe a shyster stockbroker who tried to talk you out of your money and a failed proctologist who was running out of proctors to work on came up with one of the most brilliant, brilliant recovery methodologies that's known to man. There's over 200 12-step fellowships out there. There's overeaters. There's Gamblers Anonymous. There's Families Anonymous. There's Tower Snipers Anonymous. I mean, you know, any kind of problem that you can have. Like, if you just can't help yourself and you got to climb up the tower every once in a while, there's a program that you can join and you can call your ex-tower sniping sponsor and, you know, you can go hit a meeting and you can work some steps and one day at a time, you don't need to shoot anybody, you know? These steps are brilliant and they work. Now, I'm involved in the treatment industry indirectly, but I'm huge. I'm into this thing and I know these people. And everybody writes a book. Everybody writes a book. The pharmaceutical companies invent pills. You know, new cure for alcoholism. You know, here, you know, you can do this and you can do that. Every year, if you're around long enough, you'll see the new pill that'll come out that'll help alcoholics drink normally. Okay, a little pill that you can take this pill and you can have two drinks normally without developing that craving. The problem is when confronted with this kind of a solution, I'll think, one pill, two drinks normally. If I do 10 pills, I can have 20 drinks normally. So, you know, those type of solutions are not going to work. And then they've got other methodologies. Everybody comes up with a methodology, self-awareness methodologies. All you need to do is be self-aware. But the problem is alcoholism presents, and part of the way it presents is you don't know what the hell you're doing or anything about you. So how can you be self-aware? How can you be self-aware when it's a self-illness and you have a sick self? A sick self can't help mend a sick self. You know, like a crazy mind can't mend a crazy mind. It doesn't make any sense. So there's a lot of solutions that can be presented to you today to overcome your drinking problem. But the book Alcoholics Anonymous understands that drinking is just a symptom of a spiritual illness. It is one of the most brilliant pieces of work that exists. The architecture of the big book is absolutely perfect for the recovery of alcoholism. Those guys got it, okay? Just last weekend, I interviewed a medical doctor who's a huge, you know, books, runs hospital treatment centers. And he basically, his topic was the efficacy of 12-step recovery in the medical community, what the doctors could still learn today about the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what his topic was. A lot of these people get it. And there just hasn't been anything that's come along since 1939 that supersedes the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There just isn't. And I don't think there ever will be. Bill and the boys understood that we had a spiritual malady. You treat the spirit with these spiritual exercises and everything else falls into place. It wasn't a program about not drinking. It was a program about not starting again, because that's our problem. Sobriety is our problem. So we need to learn how to live sober. And he understood that, and he understood it was a spiritual malady. Now, in step one, as Doug loves to say, step one is you're hosed. That's what step one is. You've got a mind that's going to take you back to alcohol and a body that'll ensure the alcohol will kill you. And spiritually, you're a mess. Emotionally, you're a mess. Mentally, you're a mess. You're psychopathic, practically, the way you're living your life. So good luck with that. You know, that's step one. Step two is, well, wait a minute. Maybe there's a solution. We've seen extensive recoveries that have been based on the spiritual/religious approach that was going on around the turn of the century. There was a bunch of different groups. There was the Oxford Group, the Ant Manuel Movement, the Jacobi Club, the Washingtonians. All these people had a lot of things in common. And Bill paid attention to some of these things. of us have really looked at our fault. I'll give you a really quick one. All right, the IRS is, I'm angry at the IRS. Why am I angry at the IRS? Well, they're auditing me. It's a big mess. Okay, which areas of self are affected? Well, all of them, you know. My pocketbook, my ambition, my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relations, my sex relations, all of these things are being harmed, threatened, or interfered with because this is really bad. They're going to want all my money. Okay, line of demarcation. Let's look at my own fault. Where was I selfish? Well, I wanted to keep all my money. I didn't want to be sending it off to the IRS. Where was I dishonest? I lied on my taxes. Where was I self-seeking? I wanted a boat, and if I had to give all that money to the IRS, I wouldn't have my boat, and I need that boat to be happy. Okay, where were you frightened? I was frightened. I wasn't going to get what I wanted. Now, if you're just looking at those questions, the fourth column, are your problems of your own making? You're absolutely right. And again, like Rich said, the IRS doesn't want my money. The IRS wants their money. How can I still have that deep-seated hatred for the IRS? It's my own fault. And 9 out of 10 of these resentments, when you move through them that way, you will see that your problems are of your own making. You're not living right. You know, you're not living on a spiritual basis. Second part of the fourth step is fear. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I didn't think I had fear when I came in. I was daring. I would pick on the biggest guy in the bar. I raced motorcycles, bridge diving. You know, I did crazy things. I thought I was extremely courageous. But I couldn't go get the mail without a drink. I couldn't go into grocery stores because of all those fluorescent lights and the people standing in line. People looking at you. You know, they're looking at you. What's he buying? You know? That's fear. That's fear that blocks me off. Fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It sets in motion chains of circumstances that totally hose you. That's a direct quote. That's the fifth edition. So I need to look at this. Why do I have this fear? Let me tell you what I got to with multiple inventories. In step 3, I make a decision followed by a commitment to work toward God's good and not mine. All right, what I want and my life is none of my business anymore. I've placed myself on God's team, and I need to be about his business. That's what the third step decision is. If I'm playing on God's team and I'm trying to align myself to what I think he would have me be and do, what the hell is he going to let get through to me that's not going to be good eventually? So often we see things in hindsight, and so often the things that we thought were bad were good, and the things we thought that were good were bad. And we can only see these in hindsight. It's none of my business anymore. And when I start to live on that basis, what the hell is there to be afraid of? So my fear, I begin to outgrow my fear. Now, the guilt and the remorse and the shame for the things that I did, you know, there's a beautiful inventory, a harms inventory, emphasis on sex. And you ask yourself, you look at intimate relationships. I don't believe they always have to be, you know, with someone that you're engaged in sexual relationships with. I think you can use this inventory in any with any relationship that you're close to. And there's a series of 9 questions, and you answer those questions. And you get to a point where you really see where your selfishness has caused problems in relationships. And that sets you up for 6, 7, 8, and 9, where you can actually go out and make direct amends with these people. I was giving a talk at Rutgers one time. And there was a whole series of counselors who were in this course, and they were taking their alcoholism studies there, and they were going to go off and they were going to be CDACs. You know, they were going to be the people that counsel you, you know, when you have a problem, and you can go to them and sit down and they'll help you with your alcoholism. And I was asked to go up there and speak on the steps. Now, the really crazy thing is the absolute number one recovery method in the world for alcoholism doesn't even get studied. The alcoholism counselors don't even study it. They study psychology and they study all this other stuff. It's unbelievable, but it's true. Anyway, I'm standing up there and I'm talking about steps. And I go through 1 through 12, kind of like I'm doing now, experientially and with a little bit of the mechanics. And this guy follows me out after my talk. And he's going to take exception to something that I said. And he's going, well, what about shame? What about shame? And he's like grabbing me. And I go, well, can I just ask you a couple of questions? And he goes, yeah. I go, have you ever done a four-step where you've identified everything that you could have possibly have done to harm anybody or any institution? He goes, no. I go, so then you probably haven't shared that with another individual and God. And he goes, no. And I go, well, then you never became willing to have the defects of character that have caused all these harms removed. Well, no. And you never humbly asked God to remove these character defects. No. And I go, so you probably didn't become willing to make amends, direct amends to the people that you've caused harm to, have you? And he goes, no. And I go, that would mean that you've never gone out and directly made amends to the people and institutions that you've harmed, have you? And he goes, no. I go, then how the hell do you know you can't get rid of shame? Because he was insistent that you had to deal with shame. I go, I don't have any shame. You don't have to deal with shame. What you have to do is do the steps. I go, you're giving me an opinion on shame, but you don't have an experience of recovery. Why don't you get an experience of recovery and then come back and tell me how I'm going to have to learn to deal with my shame the rest of my life? Because I don't have to. Guilt, remorse, and shame. Have you ever been walking down the road and you're afraid you're going to bump into somebody, or somebody looks like somebody that you just don't want to be bumping into? You know, you're like, whoa, you cross the street. How free do you want to be? Do you want to be able to walk across this planet without having to worry about a thing? If you do all these things, you don't have to run in and say, bartender, I'm sober, hurry up. Because sobriety is going to be fine. It's not only going to be fine, it's going to be wonderful. This is the recovery process. We don't teach you not to pick up a drink one day at a time. We teach you how to not want to pick up a drink one day at a time and be fine with that. You know, this is not about learning how to hang on by your fingers. That's not what they were interested in the early days of AA. They were interested in shifting you. You know what a miracle is? A miracle is a shift in perception. Here's what happens with alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism is on the left. A state of recovered is on the right. The difference between the two is simply this. The untreated alcoholic is living a life based on a foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness. Every decision in our lives, every way we think and act is being manipulated by that selfish and self-centered foundation that somehow we developed as alcoholics. As we move through the recovery process, our perception shifts and our method of behavior shifts. And once we're at the state called recovered, we're living a life based on love, service, and compassion. And that's how we're operating in the universe. Now, when you're operating from a selfishness and self-centered perspective, think there's going to be trouble, because that's not a real That's not a real smooth way to go through this universe. This universe isn't set up that way. That's not the way we're supposed to be. But when we're living a life of love, service, and compassion, good things happen to us. Really good things. My first experience with the four-step, remember I was going to meetings in the North Jersey area where there was not a lot of real understanding about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. People were not experienced going through the steps by this book. Alcoholics Anonymous, in somewhere in the 50s or 60s, just started to devolve into who knows what it had become. It had become a place where people sat around in a group and talked about their problems. Oh, I've got so many problems. Let me tell you about my problems. And then somebody else would raise their hand. You got problems. Let me tell you about my problems. And, you know, those are the type of meetings that I was coming into. But in the early processes of AA, it was more about this spiritual shift. More emphasis was put on this spiritual recovery process. I understood intuitively, and I know that this is the grace of God. You know, this was God. I believe that there are times in our life where the clouds of delusion part for just a short period of time, and we can see bits and pieces of truth. And if we don't grasp those, we're not going to make it. And one of the truths that came passing through my head one day was, I think I really need to do these steps. I think I need to do them. And I got about the business of doing them with the help of some recovery tapes. My first experience with the fifth step was I showed up at my sponsor's house. And I hadn't been exposed to these tapes yet, but I knew I needed to do a four-step. Now, at that period of time, what do you do if you're going to do a four-step? Well, there's this step book, isn't there, that has chapters on each step. I'll go to the step book, and I'll figure out how to do this four-step thing. Now, I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's very, very difficult to do a four-step if all you are doing is reading step four from the step book. The step book wasn't meant to be an instruction manual, although there's instructions in it. It wasn't meant to be a philosophical book, although there's philosophy in it. It wasn't meant to just be a series of stories and understandings by Bill Wilson, but that's what's in it. It was a series of essays that were basically written to sell the 12 traditions. That's why Bill wrote those 12 essays as bait to sell the traditions. And I think he did a good job with them. And I love the book, The 12 and 12. I love the book, The 12 and 12. He pins us to the wall as alcoholics in this book. Anybody that's read the first 12 steps out of The 12 and 12, you're getting hit right and left with truth. Oh, that's me. Oh, that's me. Oh, I can't believe it. Oh, he did that too. It's wonderful, and he pins us to the wall. But he doesn't explain how to go through the steps in that book. Now, I don't think he meant that book to supersede the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but it did, because as soon as it was published, a lot of the big book meetings started to disappear, and a lot of 12 and 12 meetings started to appear. The 12 and 12 was nice and tidy, and you could read the whole step in a meeting, and there was 12 steps. You know, you could go through the whole book in 3 months, and you can do that four times a year, and it made mathematical sense, and everybody started to do 12 and 12 meetings. Bill used to say something that I love a lot. He used to say, the good can sometimes be the enemy of the best. And the 12 and 12 is a great book. It's not even a good book. It's a great book. But it's the enemy of the big book when it's used wrong. If you read in the foreword, it'll basically say that the instructions are in the big book. Now, what I did was, I didn't know any better. I went to the 12 and 12. I went to step four, and I started to put together a four-step. And it was a list of character defects. It was a list of dirty little things that I had done. And I had some patterns in there of behavior that I had recognized. You know, I hadn't acted real appropriately. And I put this whole thing together and hid it under the spare tire in the back of my trunk, and ended up sharing it with my sponsor. And what it was it was more of a confessional exercise. Step four is about uncovering and discovering some truths about your stock and trade, about your nature, your alcoholic nature. It's about discovering truth. I already knew everything I put down on my four steps, so I didn't discover really any truth. What I did was I listed it down. So I see that as a confessional exercise. And a confessional exercise will give you what a confessional exercise will give you. And it gave me a real big shot in the arm, a real spiritual shot in the arm. Because when I was done reading all this, it was the first time I admitted this stuff to anybody. And my sponsor looked at me and he said, Chris, you know, you need to know something. You need to know most people that suffer from alcoholism are really unconcerned about living a better life. They're just concerned with themselves and their own problems. You're concerned with living a better life, and you're trying to do something about your alcoholism. Lighten up on yourself. You're in the minority of people that are trying to get better. So stop beating yourself up. And he goes, and then he said it like this, and I've always remembered this. He said, I believe that you were an alcoholic before you started to drink. And you were like a big campfire where the fire had gone out. And all there is left is like the red burning coals. And you're just burning. And as soon as you discovered alcohol, it was like throwing gasoline on that fire. And the gas spread out and burned you and everybody around you. He goes, you're trying to put that fire out now. You lighten up on yourself. And it was the first time in my life I started to feel human. I started to feel like maybe I wasn't such a scumbag. It wasn't until I discovered these tapes that I moved past step five. I tried to work on my character defects for a while. Anybody in here ever try to work on your character defects? Did you ever do that? Like, I'm not going to be selfish today, or I'm not going to do that. Or, I mean, how'd that work for you? I'll tell you how it worked for me. Every time I would try to work on a character defect, it was like, you ever see that game Whack-A-Mole, where you take the mallet and you whack the mole on the head and then another one pops up and you got to whack that mole? You ever see that game? It's like an arcade game. Well, me working on my defects of character was like playing Whack-A-Mole. So every single time I was trying to change myself, I was whacking the mole. And you know what happens if you keep whacking the mole? My sponsor told me this. You can go blind. So I spent about 8 months whacking the mole. And things weren't getting better. Things were getting better. And this is about the time that I got exposed to those recovery tapes. And I recognized how you work step six and how you work step seven and how you work step eight and how you work step nine. And I started to get about the business of recovery. And things started to happen in my life. The word actual is a great word to put in front of every step. If there's anything I could change in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what I would do. I would say, actually admitted you were powerless over alcohol and that your life had become unmanageable. You know, actually went out and made direct amends to, you know what I mean? Actually. And what these tapes were telling me was I didn't know anything unless I had actually done this stuff. And it was kind of a challenge. Now, a lot of times in AA, we need to take things on faith. A lot of times we don't understand and we're still asking why. Why do I need to fly to California? They'll be putting me in jail for 5 years. Why do I need? A lot of times we're still asking ourselves why. And sometimes we have to take it on faith that we just need to do this. We need to do this and place the results in God's hands. Remember, if we've made a third step decision followed up by a commitment, it's extremely rare that it's not going to be a beneficial experience to us to actually make an amend. It may be inconvenient temporarily, but it's going to end up being the right thing for us to do in our lives. So I got about the business of actually putting this together. And some people were really looking at me like I was extreme, like I was really weird. Like, you went back to your ex-boss? You know, that's not really the things that were being discussed in the ninth step meetings where I was going, where I was doing my AA. More often than not, it was, you know, it was people saying stuff like, well, you know, I went and I apologized to my wife about, you know, I said, I'm sorry, I've ruined your life for the last 30 years. And, you know, she didn't take it very well. I don't know about these steps, you know. Well, you did it wrong, you moron. You know, that's not how you do it. I wrecked your life for 30 years. Sorry. Can you make dinner? You know what I mean? And this is the kind of stuff I was hearing in the meetings. It was just pathetic. So anyway, you know, I started to get about the business of making amends. Now, I can never beat, you know, the Rich and Doug amends stories, but I've had some really good experiences, and I'll tell you a few. There was this niece that I had, and you know, I found this out by going through the four step because she reminded me so much of myself. I just couldn't stand her. She was like a reflection of me. You know, the same types of character defects I had and you know, she manifested too. And when I was really drunk, I said things to her that an uncle just doesn't say. And I treated her the way an uncle just shouldn't treat a niece. And I'm working through my ninth step, and it comes across that I need to make amends. And I was clear on what my part was. That's the great thing about step four and step eight. You get clear about what you need to make amends for. Make amends, not say you're sorry, but, you know, set right the wrong. And I got a hold of her, and I told her where I had been wrong and that I'd like to make amends, and I'd like to be more of a supportive family member in her life, and that, you know, if there's anything I can ever do for you or any way I can make any of this stuff up, and she was so stunned she couldn't even talk. No one had ever done anything like this with her before, and she didn't really know how to respond. She just basically said, This is about 1996. And I hadn't been in Key West, Florida since the scuba diving debacle trip of 78, okay? And we went down there, we drank our way through the Keys and just caused all kinds of trouble. And I remember New Year's, 1978. The last thing I remember is hopping up on stage and trying to hug the hula dancer. Okay, don't remember anything after that. I think the bouncer like knocked me unconscious because the next day I woke up in a dumpster. You know, it was about 8 o'clock and I'm in there with the crab legs and the buzzards and everything. And I climb out of the dumpster and, you know, go home. Well, I'm in Key West, Florida, and that's the last thing that happened to me in Key West. I'm in Key West 10 years later or something like that, and I'm in an AA meeting because I go to AA meetings when I'm traveling around, and I think this will be a great thing to share. So I raise my hand, and I go, you know, I've been in Key Largo before, and last thing I remember, waking up in a dumpster after trying to molest the hula dancer. And somebody raises his hand after me and goes, I know who that is. That's Lola. She still dances there. I'm like, no! You gotta be kidding me! What is the half-life of a hula dancer? I gotta get one the one that's been dancing there for 15 years in the same bar. Off I go to make amends to Lola. You know? I've had some really, really wonderful experiences with this work, with these steps. These steps are not something you should be afraid of. These steps are not something that you should try to think a lot about before you take them. When you're sitting there on an amends list, you're going to think about the worst possible scenario. If I go to that judge, I'm gonna be behind bars for 5 years. I mean, that's what you're gonna think. But that's not usually what's gonna happen. 9 times out of 10, you're gonna be gratified with the results. And I've only been thrown out of one office. And I went back there about 6 months later and got thrown out again. But I finally I was able to make amends, and that was an ex-boss. That's the only really negative amends that I've ever had. Recovery from alcoholism is contingent on this. It's very, very important to understand the importance of these steps. It's not emphasized at AA anymore the way it should be. AA has become a meeting-dependent culture. We've become the type of people who, oh man, I had a really bad week. I'm going to double up on my meetings. What? You know, we're supposed to be on the firing line of life. We're supposed to be out there trying to be of help to people. We're not supposed to be hiding in meetings. For one reason or another, maybe it's the easier, softer way to sit in meetings year after year after year and just share. Maybe that's the easier, softer way. But that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of recovery. There's a great line in the 12 and 12. The 12 steps are principles, spiritual in their nature. If when practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and enable the user to become happily and usefully whole. That's a great sentence. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's a set of principles, spiritual in their nature. If when practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and enable us to become happily and usefully whole. There's a lot of things that have come in from treatment centers, and there's a lot of mouth-flapping stuff that you hear in AA today that's really, really bad advice. There was a guy in my first home group that used to share every single time the fourth step was brought up. He would share like this. I don't know about anybody else, but it took me 4 years to do a fourth step, and I think if anybody does a fourth step before 4 years, they still got their head up their ass. It took me 4 years. This kind of talk, he might as well have had chalk marks on his big book for the newcomers he was killing. Okay? He didn't know that. He didn't know he was killing newcomers with something like that. But here, you don't wait to get better to take the 12 steps. The 12 steps are what get you better. If you were in a car accident and you were walking up to the emergency room all banged up, a couple of broken bones, you know, lacerations, and somebody stopped you at the emergency room door and said, whoa, 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 whoa. When I had my car accident, it took me 4 years before I decided to get surgery. What would you do? You'd move them out of the way, wouldn't you? I got to get in there. Well, we got to get in there too. We got to get into the steps too. It's really, really scary, the statistics in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always terrible when I start talking about the statistics because the statistics are so like unscientific. How do you get accurate statistics on a fellowship where people are anonymous and they don't want to talk to you about anything because they're anonymous? But there's various statistics out there. About 6 months ago in the Grapevine magazine, the Gray Pages have come back, by the way. Anybody know what the Grapevine Gray Pages are? It's basically about the professional side of alcoholism treatment and drug addiction treatment. But there was a very, very thorough study that was done on 12-step fellowships that involved alcohol and drugs. What they did was they went around and they did surveys of people in these meetings. And they hit like a lot of meetings and they got a lot of data to get together and they published statistics. And I'm reading this gray page and I come across a statistic that horrified me. And this is the statistic. 45% of the people they surveyed in all of these 12-step organizations have less than a month clean and sober. 45%. Do you know that the American Medical Society describes alcoholism and drug addiction as chronically relapsing conditions? That's the DSM criteria for alcoholism. When you go to a doctor and you say, "Doctor, I'm alcoholic," they'll look at you and say, "This is a chronically relapsing sumbitch. I better get my money up front." You know what I mean? That's what they see. I got to tell you, you all know and I know, we don't have to chronically relapse. We don't have to chronically relapse. But to not chronically relapse, we got to do this thing right. We can't just show up at a couple of meetings and expect through osmosis to have our lives get put back together. It takes a lot of work. And the word work is not, you know, is not the most accepted thing to hear in AA meetings today. You'll always hear somebody, "If somebody came up to me when I was new and told me that it was work and I had to do all these steps, I'd have been out of here." And the way I respond to that is, who would have cared? We don't need you. You know what I mean? If you're going to be cranky and you're going to take up a seat in AA for 20 or 30 years, it would be better if you weren't here, you know? Be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So there's always resistance to. Unfortunately, it's become politically incorrect in AA to talk about the recovery process. I speak all over the place, so do a lot of people here. And we get a lot of crap sometimes. You know, this is not what people want to hear. They want to hear that you just need to go to meetings and everything's going to be fine. If you just go to meetings, everything's not going to be fine. Everything's going to be far from fine. It says in our book, attendance at a few meetings is a far cry from permanent sobriety or recovery. There's work to do. We need to be on the firing line. We need to walk hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, helping other people day after day after day. And that may sound like a lot of work, but you get involved with it, and it's not work anymore. You do it because because you have to, until you do it because you need to, until you do it because you want to, until you do it because you love to. It's a process, and that's really what happens with alcoholism. There's a bright future out there for us, and it's directly proportional to the amount of work we put into it. Back in the early 90s, I started to bring people over to my house to take them through the steps. And I noticed something very, very significant. Very, very significant. The people who made it through 4 and 5 actually went out and did some amends and started to help other people. Every single one of those people are still in AA, card-carrying members in good standing, and their quality of life is out the roof. The people who actually went through those steps, every one of them. Now, you and I know that we lose 90% of the fellowship every 5 years. They're just gone. There's usually a little core group of people that still show up at the meeting year after year after year, but everybody else is gone. Those people that went through the steps, they're all still here. The people that didn't go through the steps, they are all gone. You know, that's significant to me.